96-3028 CR, State of Wisconsin versus O'Brien. Is it Mr. Fulmer?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
You're appearing for Mr. O'Brien. You are appearing for Mr. O'Brien.
That's correct. May it please the court, my name is John Tomier. I'm accompanied by Attorney Martin Kohler. I'm proud to be associated with. We represent Delano J. O'Brien as the felon appellant petitioner. We've come to this court to ask for relief from Mr. O'Brien based on three arguments we've articulated to the court. Mr. O'Brien, as part of post-conviction proceedings, requested that the trial court permit him to remove certain physical evidence for scientific testing, for DNA testing. The trial court denied that request, but on appeal, the Court of Appeals accepted O'Brien's idea that the right, or at least the possibility, of post-conviction discovery should exist in Wisconsin, but denied that relief to Mr. O'Brien, given the facts of his case and what was also in the record. Moreover, Mr. O'Brien argued post-conviction that his counsel was ineffective. And as part of that claim, Mr. O'Brien argued that his trial counsel failed to conduct a proper investigation of the case pre-trial. What post-conviction counsel identified was that there was what we argued was material evidence that the victim's, Mark Albert's, wrestling was relevant for purposes of challenging the credibility of Mr. Albert at trial. Specifically, Mr. Albert at trial claimed in his testimony that Mr. O'Brien was too large, that he was pinned, and that he was unable to move Mr. O'Brien. And once Mr. Albert testified to that, it was our belief that if trial counsel would have identified the wrestling record and the success that Mr. Albert had as a high school wrestler, and at the time that this alleged sexual assault occurred, Mr. O'Brien was still of high school age. I believe he was 17 or 18 at the time, and had the ability, notwithstanding his claim at trial, to move Mr. O'Brien. Now, we believe that the investigation would have yielded this information, and once Mr. Albert made this claim at trial, because this was a credibility battle at trial, that was fair game for trial counsel to, in effect, attack Mr. Albert by way of cross-examination or through rebuttal witnesses, if permissible. I appreciate the Court of Appeals' comment that the standard in Wisconsin is no means no. Mr. Albert isn't making a claim about Mr. Albert's sexual history. He wanted to challenge his credibility. And by trial counsel failing to investigate the case properly, which our investigator found it in a matter of 10 minutes by looking in the high school yearbook that Mr. Albert attended, identified that this young man was a successful wrestler, member of the varsity team, and qualified for the state championship meet.
How does it go to credibility?
It goes to credibility, Your Honor, in that this case, the facts of this case, there's no physical evidence of an attack, no scratches, there's no testimony that Albert says O'Brien tried to hit me or use a weapon or anything of that nature. There is essentially Mr. Albert's word that this happened to him, and Mr. O'Brien's claim that permissible sexual contact occurred.
But isn't that kind of, that isn't unique to this case. That's in existence in every case where there is a dispute as to the no means no question. I mean, you can make the argument of credibility that exists in every single case.
And this information was relevant because these many of these cases involve a credibility battle. And the issue of credibility is relevant in this case by the nature of the case, as you stated correctly. And because we're talking about a credibility, trial counsel salivates over a fact like a victim comes forward, we find information about a victim that is saying one thing at trial, but his history connotes something else.
I understand your argument to be, however, that no, the law is no means no. But in this case, to be distinguished from the existing law, we're offering it for credibility. My response is every single case that led up to the law means no, had the same issue. So what's different about this case?
Well, I think what's different about this case is that the credibility is not going toward Mr. Albert's sexual history, whether he was promiscuous, whether he was dressed in a certain way, that the things that historically created the no versus no rule. Therefore, the credibility as defense counsel, you find out information about the victim because the victim, Albert, in this sense is saying, I said no, and how does one attack whether he said no or not, or whether that's believable in terms of the jury? Well, in this case, one of the means of doing that is having the jury weigh whether Mr. Albert is saying no and if that's believable versus Mr. Albert, isn't it true that you were a high school wrestler and you had a special ability? And therefore, when you testify that you said no, but at the same time you're also testifying you couldn't move Mr. O'Brien, that he was much, much larger than him, and he considered physical force, but he didn't.
So the fact that if he was a high school football player, or he played volleyball, or he played basketball would not be significant, but you want to get in the fact that because you believe that a wrestler has certain moves or knows certain holds, that he should have been able. Isn't that a kind of a dangerous proposition when you get into this whole area? Then the court, it's an interesting concept, but can you imagine that from any standpoint, if no doesn't mean no, then you're going to go back and say, well, you played this sport or that sport, or you had that ability, and therefore you should have been able to do this. It's kind of conjecture. As opposed to a 160-pound person being sat upon by a 230-pound person, and you had which came out that they had a substantial difference in weight.
I appreciate your concern that if this court were to adopt a standard to permit this type of credibility challenge, then trial courts would perhaps be placed in a difficult position of splitting hairs. Does volleyball players or badminton come in? But in this case, O'Brien has argued that he's termed it a special ability.
Is there any legal duty on the part of the victim to resist?
Oh no, we're not making that claim. There is no claim that there is any affirmative duty.
You're saying that. You may not be articulating it in those words, but you seem to be saying that because he had this special ability of wrestling, he could have escaped had he so desired. Because he didn't attempt to escape, he consented. This was a consensual relationship. And I'm asking you, did he have any duty at all to try to escape?
And my answer to you is no, he has no duty to escape. And perhaps I've written it poorly or explained it poorly today. Our argument is not that he has a duty to escape, and it goes to the issue of consent. The argument about Albert's wrestling ability goes to challenge his credibility because he testified at trial that he was pinned, O'Brien was larger than him, and he considered if I remember the testimony correctly, he considered punching him, those types of things. A response of the jury could easily interpret that because of the size difference and because he was pinned, etc., he couldn't move. And we, through our investigation, found evidence to the contrary.
Well, did he have a duty to move?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Did he have a legal duty to try to move?
He did not have a legal duty to try to move, and that is not what we believe we have tried to argue in this case.
Well, it sure sounds like it, counsel. I'm not getting it.
When Mr. Albert, on direct testimony, said, I was pinned and I couldn't move, etc., that doesn't comport with his ability to truthfully testify about what he could do.
Well, the issue of whether or not he resisted is immaterial under Wisconsin law. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So why is the attack on credibility that you're asserting here material as to whether or not he resisted? If indeed, at the very best, you have impeachment on a collateral issue, since it's not a relevant issue that he resisted.
It's not relevant.
And I don't think...
I'm sorry. It's not relevant in the sense that Albert has no duty to move. But our position is once Mark Albert says, I was pinned, etc., as I've said before, he is making testimony under oath to a jury. And we have information that that testimony is subject to attack based on Albert's background and ability. And I'm not trying to split hairs here. We understand that he has no duty to move. But once Mark Albert says, I didn't have that ability, then it's our position, the trial counsel should
have... Is that what he testified to? Did he say, I didn't have the ability to move?
No, not in those words. And I apologize. He said, my recollection is that I was pinned, that Mr. Albert weighed substantially more than me, and I think Detective Gus approximated 230 pounds, if I recall correctly, and that he was straddled, and that he considered punching O'Brien. He said he was scared, and he said that he told Mr. O'Brien no several times. And it's our position that if the jury is to assess whether Mr. Albert is telling the truth as to what happened that night, the factual scenario that he claimed happened does not comport with what we found out about his background. And if the jury is going to make a determination about who is telling the truth, they should have been aware that Mr. Albert does have a special ability. And if I can move on to the Court of Appeals opinion, if the Court of Appeals opinion holds that there's obviously no special duty, and that doesn't change the law, but this type of ability is immaterial, and if that's the law in Wisconsin, then other issues of potential materiality give way as well. As I referenced in the brief, if the victim had a gun, or if the victim was a black belt in karate, and perhaps that addresses your concern, Your Honor, about how are we going to split hairs about what's in and what's out versus material in relevance to materiality. And so my position is that trial courts are in the business of making these case-by-case determinations every day of the week. And if something rises to the level of a credibility challenge, and it crosses that threshold of materiality, then the jury should be able to hear about it, notwithstanding the normal rule that no means no, and there's no affirmative duty to move. It's our position that they are two separate things. That we're not claiming that the no versus no rule should change. We're not claiming that there's an affirmative duty for Albert to have done anything. But once Albert testifies about facts defense counsel is in the posture of challenging those facts.
So defense counsel would have said to the victim, you are our wrestler, right? Yes. And would have asked how many, how he was he trained, and how did he do in various competitions, and had he ever removed a 230-pound person from his chest? I mean, is that what you view as the appropriate cross-examination?
Something along those lines, as well as, what is your understanding of a successful wrestler? Meaning leverage versus weight is the determining factor in being a successful wrestler. And isn't it true, Mr. Albert, that you were a very successful wrestler? So when Mr. O'Brien says to you, when you claim to the jury that Mr. O'Brien was much larger than you, but that he was pinning you and you couldn't move, that's not true, is it, Mr. Albert?
Okay, so he could have resisted. But he feared resisting. So if he could have resisted, does that mean that it was consent?
No. And if I've stated it poorly in the brief, we're not suggesting...
Just raises the credibility whether it's consent.
That's correct. Credibility, whether the facts are what Mr. Albert says they were.
And if they weren't, then you have to assume consent. That's an inference.
That's an inference. And our position is, because this comes in by way of an effectiveness, that the investigation should have revealed at least this information. We've also...
What does the record show about the trial counsel's knowledge on this point?
Absolutely none. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Absolutely none.
You're not sure, then, that the trial counsel didn't actually know that the victim was arrested?
Oh, it's not in the record whether that was affirmatively obtained by his trial counsel. We were not in the position of obtaining a Mockner hearing in this case. The process whereby trial counsel is subjected to examination for his performance. However, outside of the record, we have information that it wasn't found out. He didn't look.
But there was no Mockner hearing.
There was no Mockner hearing. Judge McCormick determined that our arguments were not of the quality that rose to the level of deficiency and therefore prejudice, and therefore deterred our opportunity to have a Mockner hearing.
Counsel, if I remember correctly, one of the reasons that the court took this case related to the issues tied to post-conviction discovery. Would you address your position in regard to post-conviction discovery and what you're asking this court to adopt as a rule in that regard?
Yes, you've correctly stated that part of our claim is that a defendant should have an opportunity to engage in post-conviction discovery. And as its genesis, it starts with the statute 971.23.5. We asked, and that's the statute providing for the specific removal of exhibits for scientific testing, pre-trial. And that's clear in the statute. But from that statutory scheme, as well as there's a genesis of case law that's existed pre-trial, that criminal defendants can show a particularized need for certain items that are otherwise privileged and confidential, that a criminal defendant can ask for an in-camera review of that material, and the trial court judge can make a determination whether or not the defense should have that material for purposes of trial. It's our position that the Supreme Court rules provide an ethical duty on behalf of the prosecutor and defense attorney to, when there is information available that tends to negate guilt, There's an ethical responsibility to turn over such material.
Well, is it your position that the guidelines suggested by the Court of Appeals are appropriate ones, or do you feel that they ought to be altered in some way?
We feel that the guidelines established by the Court of Appeals, which from what I recall, more or less adopts the standard that is found in Oklahoma, and I'll call it just generally the materiality standard, that the evidence that post-conviction counsel seeks to identify, in our case, have removed and tested, has to be of the quality that its results would have a reasonable probability of changing the outcome of the case. And we have not objected to the adoption of the Court of Appeals standard of materiality for purposes of post-conviction discovery, because I happen to agree with Judge Anderson in that there should be certain limits placed on this process, certain checks available to the trial court in terms of post-conviction proceedings to ensure that the post-conviction process is not abused. But our fundamental belief, and the reason we started this all together, was just because there's a judgment of conviction doesn't mean that a defendant's rights terminate. And if our goal is to seek the truth, if the truth was not identified by trial counsel before the trial or during the course of the trial, and if post-conviction counsel has identified information that leads to a fair determination of guilt or innocence, and it wasn't elicited prior to trial, then there should be a process available for post-conviction counsel and appellate counsel to seek to have the matter fully litigated. And that triggers, from this court's reading or opinion in Hicks, that the potential for an interest of justice standard also provides a basis for post-conviction discovery, in that what is found through post-conviction process for discovery, if it yields material that shows that evidence that the matter was not fully litigated, then that provides a basis.
I want to focus on that. The Court of Appeals has four elements in its standard for post-conviction discovery. Do you agree with those four standards?
Yes. As we've claimed in our brief, we did not challenge that standard. We just wanted Del O'Brien to have a chance to meet it and go back to the trial court.
Do I understand that you want to add a fifth element, kind of in the interest of justice, to that four-prong test? Or
that's not correct. What I was summarizing was we provided the Court of Appeals with a range of options to establish post-conviction
but
discovery.
You are in accord with the four-prong standard set forth on page 12 of the Court of Appeals opinion. Is that correct?
Yes.
What was discovered after conviction?
What was discovered after conviction?
The only reason I ask you, you're stating it in legal terms, post-conviction discovery. What was discovered after conviction?
What was discovered after conviction was the realization that the penile swabs collected from Mark Albert, the victim in this case, contained semen. The lab report provided referenced an inconclusive result.
As to
the source of the semen, whether it was Mark Albert's or Del O'Brien's. And what the Court of Appeals determined or found was that Albert or O'Brien was able to successfully argue to the jury that the semen was Albert's. But that's not evidence. So to answer your question, there was nothing truly discovered post-conviction because counsel's request to remove the exhibits to test the penile swabs, to determine the source of the semen, whether it was Albert's or O'Brien, to later then advance an argument about ineffectiveness, was not able to be undertaken because the trial court denied his request to remove the exhibits for testing.
Now, but you said the tests were inconclusive. Why do you think a second test, that's what you wanted to do, right? A second test on this material?
Right. You know,
I think they would show more than the first test.
We believe that the state crime lab's ability to test certain material may have a flaw. We had enrolled an expert in Oklahoma that explained to us in detail the possibility of flawed testing, and we had disclosed that to the trial court, that an independent test may in fact be able to determine the source.
The discovery was to determine the source.
That's
that would
right.
have been the new evidence that was not previously available because of flawed testing that counsel had not brought to the attention of anyone. Is that your point?
Actually, the point is that the party stipulated to the findings of the test, and that we believe that independent testing, he should at least have the right to see if a more sophisticated test, as the court may know, there are, I think, three types of DNA testing, and the type of testing we had lined up dealt with very small samples, which raises the probability of determining the source.
What exhibits do you want removed for examination? You want the penile swabs?
As well as the anal swabs.
Well, what were the anal swabs going to show?
The anal swabs we would want tested for hemoglobin testing and DNA testing. The stipulated report was helpful to O'Brien in terms of the anal swabs because it didn't show the presence of semen. But also, and this is perhaps an ambiguity in the briefing, but the record reveals that there was no reference to blood affirmatively or negatively. What it essentially showed was there were no tearing or lacerations.
So you want the anal swabs to show the absence of blood?
That's correct. And from there, again, based on a scientific understanding, we would advance an argument concerning whether that event occurred, meaning anal sex. Albert claimed there was oral sex as well as anal sex. I see that my time is up unless the court has further questions.
The second test, that the moving party was not negligent in failing to discover it earlier. Isn't that the second test? Am I quoting that correctly?
Oh, yes, in the post-conviction removal standard.
How do you make that test? No, counsel, I was reading from a different part of your brief.
Okay.
I will withdraw that question.
Unless there are further questions.
Justice Counsel. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have time for rebuttal. Mr. Walford, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General William C. Wolford, representing the state of Wisconsin in this matter. I'm going to address all three issues raised by the defendant in this case, the first one dealing with post-conviction discovery. I'm going to deal with the issue that the defendant is really raising in his brief, namely that the court treated him unfairly because it didn't apply, or that rather it did apply the post-conviction standards to him. because he doesn't really challenge what the new standards are or should be. It's our contention that he wasn't treated unfairly because they did not apply the new standards to him, and he shouldn't be given an opportunity to have them applied to him at this point because he can't meet the new standards established by the court. In the decision, the Court of Appeals established guidelines for post-conviction discovery. However, contrary to the defendant's claim, the Court of Appeals did not apply the new guidelines in considering his motion. They applied an erroneous exercise of discretion standard of review for pretrial discovery in considering his motion in order not to require the defendant to meet standards that he couldn't have known about. The defendant put forth a number of bases for his motion for post-conviction discovery. There was no right, however, to post-conviction discovery on a statutory basis, and several of the other bases that he raised simply weren't applicable. In the Court of Appeals, he suggested he had a right to post-conviction discovery under the Shifra line of cases because of the obligation of the state to turn over exculpatory evidence and because the results of the testing would constitute newly discovered evidence. However, to succeed on any of these claims, he would have to show there was a reasonable probability that the evidence would lead to a different result. This is, in essence, the same test as the last standard newly adopted by the Court of Appeals. That's our position that he can't meet that standard under either the old law or the new law, and therefore he shouldn't be entitled to have another kick at the cat. The Court of Appeals properly concluded that the evidence the defendant hoped to obtain through testing would not have changed the result. First of all, this semen on the victim's penis. Even if the testing conclusively showed that the semen on the victim's penis was that of the victim, this wouldn't have changed the result of the trial. The fact that the victim admitted semen does not mean that the victim consented. This is pure speculation. The victim testified he didn't consent, both by saying no. He also testified that he moved his body in particular ways to make it clear he was not consenting to the activity. And the defense argued to the jury that the semen found on the victim's penis was that of the victim, and the state didn't challenge his claim. So basically, the case was tried on the theory that the semen that was shown in the crime lab tests on the victim's penis was that of the victim, but the jury still convicted the defendant. So it isn't going to change the result. As far as the fact that there's no blood or semen on the anal swabs and smears, even if testing conclusively showed that there was no blood or semen found on the anal swabs and smears, this isn't going to change the result of the trial either. The jury heard during trial there was no semen identified on the anal swabs and smears. They heard that the nurse's physical examination of the victim disclosed zero anal lacerations or tears. This was totally consistent with the defense theory that there was no anal intercourse. The defense emphasized in its opening and in its closing that there was no physical evidence of anal intercourse. And the prosecutor admitted in her closing argument there was no semen found on the anal swabs. So this is not going to change the result either, this anal evidence that the defendant seeks. And by the way, just a slight correction. These swabs and smears are not actually trial exhibits. They're preserved somewhere, but they weren't admitted into evidence at the trial. Rather, there was a stipulation about what the results of the crime lab tests were, and there was also a stipulation about what the nurse's physical examination found.
Does that make any difference whether they were evidence or that there was a stipulation?
No. I don't think so. I'm just saying that, in fact, they weren't.
So what the fight is about is that there are swabs or there is DNA evidence in the possession of the state, which the defense would like to test
for purposes they've set forth.
That's correct.
And the objection of the prosecution is not material, in effect.
That's correct.
They don't change themselves. Therefore, you don't want to give them the evidence. If you had given them the evidence and they found that there was no blood from the anal smear, which one would expect, and which would help them, theoretically, and if it found that smear from the penis was only the victim's semen, then what would the defense do? You know, those are what I view as favorable to the defense. That's what they're looking for, right?
Correct.
Okay, then what would their next step be?
Well, I'm not certain what their next step would be, but they filed this motion in anticipation of filing their post-conviction motion, and they raised...
for a new trial.
Right, and they raised such issues as newly discovered evidence, ineffective assistance. Ultimately, they're not going to succeed on any of those claims because they can't show a reasonable probability that the results would be different.
Well, to state your position another way, I want to see if I understand it. Your position is that you don't have to give them evidence unless the evidence was such that they could win on a motion for a new trial.
That's basically correct.
That's your position. So that your position, if I'm correct in stating it, is that you would test whether they could get this evidence by the various standards for a motion for a new trial.
In essence, that's correct.
And my next question is the four standards that, and I have not done this myself yet, have the four standards that the Court of Appeals set forth on page 12 of its opinion, they fit the motion for new trial provisions? Because they should be consistent. I'm questioning whether they should be consistent.
Well,
have I made myself clear?
I think so. We are not challenging those new standards. We think that they're generally appropriate. In the Court of Appeals, we did not propose specific standards other than we did propose the materiality standard, in other words, standard number four, because we think that is very important. We're not saying, even though there's no statutory authority for post-conviction discovery, that there should never be a right to post-conviction discovery.
Well, counsel, you said you came under four on materiality. The way I see it, you come in under three.
By materiality, I mean materiality in the sense that the results would show a reasonable probability of a different outcome, such as materiality for purpose of exculpatory evidence.
It seems to me your argument is that it's not even relevant. Your argument is that regardless of whose semen was on the penis, his ejaculation does not mean that it wasn't rape.
With respect to that particular issue, we are. We do say that.
And I think your argument as to the blood would be that it's cumulative. A lack of the blood, which is what they want to show, fits with other evidence they had, which was there wasn't any tear or any laceration.
There was evidence of zero anal lacerations and tears.
I guess what I'm getting at is, for purposes of this case, court doesn't have to set forth standards that are going to bind every other case.
I agree, and every case may be different. This case may, this may, standard may fit, but it may not in some other.
And the defendant here is not really debating these standards. And you're not either.
That's correct.
Okay. That's all.
I have a question on the standards. And the Court of Appeals opinion. On page 10 of the Court of Appeals opinions, they begin to discuss the threshold burden. And they state that the defendant must be required to show that the evidence sought to be gained is material. That's how they begin their discussion. Then, two pages later, on page 12, they set out the four standards that they are going to require that the defendant must show in making his request. And number four, again, seems to state the same standard of materiality. Is standard number four set out by the Court of Appeals the same thing as what they stated on page 10?
I think it is. And
I think we need to say that to clarify.
I think it would be helpful to clarify. And part of the confusion and problem here is that there are issues involved in this case that require the use of the word material in two different ways. Material in the sense of relevant to an issue of consequence in the litigation, that type of material, and that's what they're talking about in standard number three, I think. And number four, I think they are talking about their materiality test on page four, but in this particular case, they don't call it materiality on page 12. But I think that's in fact what we're talking about.
A substantial probability of a different result or whatever that is.
Reasonable probability of a different outcome. Right.
The evidence code defines materiality in along with relevancy.
It's now part of 90401.
That's right.
Yes.
Mr. Wolford, let me ask you a question that gets a little bit more toward policy, perhaps. It's my understanding that the discovery rules were really a creature of the legislature. The 971-23-5, as an example, was adopted by the legislature, that they spelled out pretrial discovery rules. Why should we, being the court system, now spell out post-conviction discovery rules? If there are to be such, why shouldn't we leave that to the legislature?
Well, that's a policy question I think that the court will have to decide. I'm not suggesting that you should set out standards or that the Court of Appeals should. Really, we were focused on this particular case and the ability of the defendant to be able to obtain post-conviction discovery without any statutory basis for it.
So you're really not advocating that this court set forth guidelines?
No, I'm not. I do feel that there are instances where post-conviction discovery is appropriate, despite the fact that there is no present statutory authorization for it.
So you're not going to say that a trial court can't order? You don't want this court to rule that a trial court can never order post-conviction discovery just because there's no statute?
No, but we feel that they should have to meet a fairly high burden in order to obtain it, because there's a lot of post-conviction practice right now, and this is going to be a further burden on it.
And you do agree with the way the Court of Appeals laid it out?
We have no particular objection to the way that they...
Is there anything else in that opinion? If we're going to address the standards, we've already indicated one area that may need some clearing up. Anything else that might need cleaning up? Any other language as to how the Court of Appeals stated it?
Nothing that I can think of particularly at this stage.
Counsel, could we move to the first question concerning the scope of the search warrant?
Certainly.
As I understand the law, arguably the law is that ownership makes no difference. Your position is ownership makes no difference as long as, in this case, the vehicle is on the premises. The underlying question is, does ownership make any difference in terms of a search on a premises?
I think it doesn't make any difference under the physical proximity test that's been adopted by the court in Andrews. In some of the federal cases, it may make a difference, or at least that there needs to be some sort of control. In this case, you don't have to deal with that issue because, in fact, the police knew before they went into the vehicle that the vehicle was registered to the defendant.
Did they know that there was any connection between the vehicle and the incident? In other words, is there anything on the record that says that the defendant went to his vehicle? I mean, I find it rather odd, given the facts as I know them, that they would even think to search behind the driver's seat. And I understand it was kind of crumpled and hidden behind there. What's the nexus? What causes them to search this car?
I don't think there's anything in the record that indicates they had a particular reason to look in the vehicle, other than the fact that, and you can see if you look at the photos, which are trial exhibits 8 and 10 in document 101, the vehicle is very close to the residence, and they had looked in the apartment of the defendant. They had looked elsewhere, and they hadn't found what they were looking for, and this was small enough to fit within that vehicle. So it's reasonable to me that they did so, but they had no specific information about it.
If this were a 10-acre lot, and the car were parked at the other end of the 10 acres as from the location of the upper unit of the duplex, everything else being the same, is there any difference in the result?
Well, maybe perhaps a different result. The defendant suggests that there are no limits on the tests set by the Court of Appeals, and suggest that anything can be searched even if it's outside the curtilage, if it's on the premises. And the trial court found that the vehicle was within the curtilage, and the Court of Appeals decision doesn't say that it wasn't. So I don't think that the Court of Appeals decision can be read to necessarily say that anything on the premises anywhere is searchable.
If you define premises as Black's Law Dictionary does, or a common dictionary does, which is the building and land, it doesn't, I don't think, require any kind of proximity. Under the plain wording of the warrant, why wouldn't that 10-acre back situation include the vehicle being able to be searched?
It might be. It might be within the scope of the warrant, but I'm saying that.
I'm not arguing that.
But I'm not arguing that. I'll
suppose the jeans hadn't been listed there and everything else had been listed. Still search the car? Do you have to be actually looking for something in the search warrant to search the car?
I think you have to be searching for something that's listed in the warrant that will fit within whatever you're looking into. And both the jeans and the underwear would fit within the vehicle. I'm now going to address the ineffective assistance of counsel issue. And our position is that the trial court and the Court of Appeals properly concluded that the trial counsel was not ineffective in failing to investigate and discover that the victim was a successful high school wrestler because the defendant had failed to show prejudice. The Court of Appeals was correct that the victim's high school wrestling experience is not material because under the sexual assault statute, a victim is not required to physically resist the assault, and the jury was so instructed in this case. The real issue in the case was not whether the victim physically resisted, but whether the victim consented. Now, defendant claims the wrestling evidence was relevant to the victim's credibility. I just want to note that the victim didn't really testify that he tried to get away but could not. And I refer the court to pages 138 and 144 of document 95, where that testimony really is. He testified he didn't think he could get away from the defendant because the defendant was much bigger and because he was afraid of him. And he said there was not much he could do. But he really didn't testify that he tried and was unable to. But even if it was admissible on the victim's credibility, it wouldn't have made any difference in the case. As was previously brought out by Justice Wilcox, there was a weight difference of up to 70 pounds in this case between the two parties. People don't wrestle with the weight differences of that large an amount. And the jury saw the victim at trial. He was physically fit. The jury knew that the defendant had brought him out there to perform physical labor, to plant trees. They could look at his appearance and assess his ability to get away in terms of deciding whether he was lying or not. So I don't think there would have been any difference in the case. In addition, the really strong evidence here was that the victim, after the assault, flagged down this police officer, and he was extremely upset. He didn't have any pants on at that point. And, I mean, I think this was very strong evidence that he didn't consent to this activity. I just wanted to address an issue that was raised in my opponent's brief about this issue. I do think that if the court concludes that this type of evidence is relevant on credibility, it's going to be hard to trim the scope of it. I think that there's a danger that the ability to escape can be asked about in most cases, and the jury may become confused and think there is in fact a duty to resist in some way, even though there's not supposed to be a duty to resist.
Counsel, I have a follow-up question, again, on the scope of the warrant. Is it your position that under the Court of Appeals opinion, if the vehicle had been a large recreational vehicle, an RV, you know, with kitchen and living room and dining room, and that it were owned by the downstairs tenant, but in the same common location, that that could be searched?
I think under the physical proximity test that the Court of Appeals used, I think that it could be, because that...
So do I, and I find that a little outrageous. And so I have a problem with that. I'm not sure it is outrageous, but there's just something to me that says, look, if this RV is owned, you know, and potentially lived in on occasion, or maybe on that occasion, by a downstairs tenant, it's not named in the warrant, but it's on the premises, under the law, ownership makes no difference, that they, under the Court of Appeals opinion, can come into an RV and search that with no particularity in the warrant. Is that bothersome to you?
Well, it's certainly more troublesome than the facts of this case, where it was registered to the defendant. Under some of the other tests, that might not be possible. If, for instance, if they knew that the vehicle was registered to someone else, but I think under the physical proximity test, it is. And I also think the trial court and the Court of Appeals were clear that the warrant did not authorize the search of the downstairs apartment that was lived in by a tenant.
What did the warrant actually say? Did it give an A or B on the address?
My recollection is that it talked about the upstairs of the particular address for the residence.
According to the Court of Appeals, the search warrant at issue here authorized certain premises in the town of Saukville occupied by O'Brien, and more particularly described as follows: 1618 Hawthorne Drive, brown in color, sided with white-trimmed two-family residence, specifically upper flat.
Right.
Thank you.
But then, according, the Court of Appeals goes on and says the specific mention of a residence doesn't limit the scope to that area. It just makes it more identifiable. It's as if you can search anything, any premises of the town of Saukville occupied by O'Brien, and this is just to make sure that the police officers don't go to the wrong house. I mean, that's the way this Court of Appeals decision reads. Do you agree with that?
I think the proper result here, and I'm not sure that the Court of Appeals is saying anything other than this, is that there wasn't, in fact, authority to search the lower premises because the warrant specifically talked about the upper flat being the residence of the defendant. He was the target of the warrant, and they knew that the lower flat was occupied by a tenant.
They go on and cite United States versus Powell Masano with a parenthetical. Specific reference to the areas in a search warrant was for the purpose of identifying the premises and was not intended to limit the area to be searched. Suppose they saw freshly dug up soil in the backyard or front yard or on Justice Bradley's 10 acres. Can they dig up that soil to look for the genes?
I think they probably could.
And if the outbuilding, let's say a barn outbuilding, was actually primarily used by the downstairs tenant, could they go into that barn outbuilding even though it wasn't referenced in the warrant?
I think that they probably could under the physical proximity test and probably under some of the other tests too, unless they had specific notice that it was used by the other tenant.
Well, so is that what the state's asking this court to hold? That here's a premise warrant and it's only for identification when you name the upper residence, and that what the warrant really means is look for these items anywhere close by that you can find them. Like, I mean, this is what they say at page 7. Clearly, the truck, the barn, and the outbuilding were plausible repositories for either of those items, being the underwear or blue jeans. I mean, is that what the state wants us to hold?
I think that the Court of Appeals properly applied the physical proximity test, and the limits on that test are the curtilage limit, the fact that the repository has to be a plausible one, in other words, that the items they're looking for fit within that repository, and they can't search for items that are worn by or in the physical possession of people on the premises whose search is not authorized by the search warrant. Unless there are other questions, I would ask the...
Quick question. When was the defendant arrested?
When was he arrested?
Yeah.
I believe he was arrested within a day or two after the...
After the search.
I think it was after the search, yes.
Let me just extend the hypothetical. If the barn or outbuilding is rented by the downstairs tenant, can they search in there?
I think that they can under the physical proximity test.
If in outbuilding, the downstairs tenant is actually living on occasion in that outbuilding, can they search in there? Sleeping at night, husband and wife in the downstairs. One's not in the doghouse, instead they're in the barn.
Not certain about the answer to that.
How do you draw the line? If it's rented and used, if the outbuilding is rented and used by the downstairs tenant, they can, but if the use includes one overnight a month, they can't. I mean, I just don't understand.
I think Under the physical proximity test, you don't draw the line on that basis. You draw it, as I previously discussed, and the fact that it might, ownership doesn't necessarily make a difference unless the person is wearing something or it's in the physical possession. But it is limited if the search warrant itself indicates an intent to just search a particular part of a residence that's owned by somebody. And in this particular case, they were just clearly searching for the defendant's residence and excluding the tenant's residence.
But doesn't a premises mean the whole area? I mean, that's what I thought, that's what in part we're dealing with.
It was, does, but,
that's,
but...
They didn't say the residence, they said the premises. That's the problem.
But the court held that the areas around that residence were common areas to both the residences, both that of the tenant and the defendant. The residence of the tenant, I think, is more important as far as protection from a search warrant.
So your answer then is that if he had wanted to hide these effectively from your search warrant, he should have given it to the downstairs neighbors in a sack. Gave them to a sack and says, hold this for me. Then that wouldn't have been covered under the warrant.
They wouldn't have been covered under this particular search warrant.
Might have been able to get another search warrant. Okay, but that's where you draw the line.
Right.
While the neighbors are in that downstairs apartment.
Well, I don't know that it matters that they're there at the time.
So if they're not there and the door was open, police should not go in there with that search warrant.
I think that that's correct.
Okay.
So we would ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bowman.
A few comments in rebuttal. There's a question asked about why should this court undertake the approval of post-conviction discovery rules when it is perhaps a creature of the legislature. And I think because we're dealing with constitutional principles here in terms of due process, and because there is a body of law that exists in other states that this court can look to, and courts of Wisconsin can look to, like Illinois, Florida, Oklahoma, Maryland, as well as the federal rules and case law, that this court, and also Wisconsin case law, obviously, that there is policy authority to determine that post-conviction rules should apply and should be available to defendants if they fit a specific set of criteria. There was also a question of, yes?
If this court adopts the Court of Appeals guidelines, how does that hurt Mr. O'Brien? How does that hurt you?
Well, it hurts Mr. O'Brien in the sense that the trial court and the Court of Appeals determined that what Mr. O'Brien was seeking to have tested, if the results were even favorable to him, they're not material. That it would not have changed the outcome of the trial. We take a different view of that, but I think that centrally, that's in the logic of the trial court and the Court of Appeals, that's where he's hurt the most.
If you're going to have post-conviction discovery, I think you admitted there have to be certain tests that are met. And the Court of Appeals said that you didn't meet those tests, or didn't they even apply a lesser standard?
That's correct. The Court of Appeals applied the arguably lesser standard that is available to pretrial discovery. And the trial court, and is affirmed by the Court of Appeals, determined that O'Brien failed to even meet that standard. At the time we filed our motion to remove the exhibits, Hicks was pending in this court. Stephen Hurley from Madison, had a stipulation from the Dane County DA to remove the hair to have tested by DNA. As well as the case authority that existed that we argued provided the right for us to remove those exhibits. It was a motion in anticipation of our post-conviction motion hearing brief. Proof as to materiality was referenced in our motion to removal, a very lengthy footnote with extensive sources that were explained, we think were explained on the record as to what our theory was purported to the trial court, as well as a specific naming of the expert that would have testified about the DNA analysis, as well as the understanding, the scientific understanding of the human male sexual response, so that at the time of the post-conviction hearing, that evidence would have been proffered. So if the, while the Court of Appeals arguably chastise us for not filing an affidavit and doing certain things as part of our motion to remove exhibits, at the time we filed the motion was novel in Wisconsin. We believe we laid the groundwork out for the trial court to ascertain what our arguments would be and what we would be able to prove, but it was our position that we shouldn't be placed in the position of putting the cart before the horse. Let us remove and test the exhibits, and then if the semen was determined to be Mark Albert's, and if the anal swabs and smears revealed additional helpful information, then we are able to argue with supportive evidence, not speculation, but supportive test results, to raise our theory that the evidence is material, that the outcome would have been different. We were not allowed to remove those exhibits.
But essentially, you argued to the jury the truth of the evidence that you saw. In other words, you really weren't. It wasn't a cumulative what you were trying to get. Weren't you trying to just simply firm up with additional evidence the arguments that you made to the jury?
And notice that my time is up.
You may answer the question.
Thank you. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals specifically referenced that O'Brien's trial counsel argued to the jury the source of the semen, for example. As we referenced in our reply brief, the jury is specifically instructed that the arguments of counsel are not evidence. They're not permitted to draw any conclusion from it. There was no evidence at that trial by way of the witness stand that semen was Mark Albert's. If there are no other questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. That ends the hearing on 96-3028-CR. When counsel table is cleared, we'll call the next case, Wisconsin versus Armstrong.